Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet this week. On the show today, we're discussing environmental and human exposure to pesticides. People living or working near industrial agriculture, particularly rural areas, will be very interested to hear from my special guest, Carl Tupper, staff scientist with the Pesticide Action Network North America and coordinator of their environmental monitoring program. Carl Tupper holds a master's degree in inorganic chemistry from the University of California, Berkeley. He joined the Pesticide Action Network North America, or PANA, in 2006 to support the Drift Catcher program, training community groups to collect air samples and analyzing these samples for pesticides. Immediately prior to joining PANA, Carl worked for Sunlight and Power, installing rooftop solar electric arrays and making biodiesel out of waste vegetable oil collected from local restaurants. He has also held analytical jobs at Pfizer Inc. and Abbott Laboratories and conducting research on the organometallic chemistry of scandium at UC Berkeley. Carl Tupper, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Helen. Great to be here.
Now, you live in California, the agricultural state of America, so to speak. And so let's first talk about how you got involved in pesticide research and its effect upon humans. And then let's talk about the Drift Catcher program.
Sure. Well, I've always been very interested in science in general. I think for as long as I've been around, if you had asked me when I was 5 years old, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? I would have said some kind of scientist. And at the same time, I've also been always really interested in environmental issues. Mm. And I'd pursued these two interests separately from one another for most of my life. Going to school, majoring in chemistry, which I found really fascinating, and then getting a graduate degree, studying, you know, the reactions of really esoteric molecules, while at the same time trying to live a very conscious lifestyle, and, you know, being mindful of my impact on the world, and trying to live a life like that. But eventually I got to the point where it seemed like, you know, the two were sort of working at cross purposes. I was looking at in grad school, I was looking at the kind of research I was doing and the job that people with my background were getting, and it was working for companies like Dow and ExxonMobil and DuPont, or smaller companies that just subcontract for these bigger chemical companies. And I knew I didn't want to do that. So that led me to the first job you mentioned, which was installing solar panels and making biodiesel out of waste vegetable oil. And that was a lot of fun. It wasn't so intellectually challenging. And so eventually I came across a job listing for Pesticide Action Network. And, you know, I must confess at the time I hadn't really given a whole lot of thought to pesticide issues, but in just reading what the job was about, you know, the job description, it totally clicked and made sense. And so I applied, and here I am. And so what that job description was, and what I'm doing now, or one of the things I'm doing now at PANA, is looking at pesticide exposure from pesticide drift. So, you know, if you live next to a field that's being sprayed with pesticides, you might reasonably think that you're breathing some of those pesticides in just by virtue of, you know, being in the vicinity of where they're being sprayed. And surprisingly, this mode of exposure has been largely ignored by, regulatory authorities here in the United States and elsewhere. And so PANA, Pesticide Action Network North America, had started this program to do air monitoring and try to actually, you know, take air samples from these areas and look for pesticides in the air samples and then try to, you know, to try to see what the exposure levels were. And so there was a job opening to do that here at PANA, and I applied, and here I am.
And Carl Tupper, did you work on any nasty chemicals in the previous jobs you had? Where were you working? Pfizer and Abbott and the like?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point to make, in that I think a lot of environmentalists, especially those working in the toxics movement, we get branded by the opposition as being, you know, chemophobic, like, oh, we hate all chemicals and we're just, you know, fearmongers and overly, you know, overreactive when it comes to chemicals. But, you know, my own background was, you know, working up close and personal with really dangerous chemicals for a number of years.
Like what?
In graduate school, primarily, you know, I was distilling benzene and working with mercury and heavy metals, you know, halogenated aromatic molecules that are, you know, strongly associated with things like cancer and reproductive harm. And I worked with these things on a daily basis and you know, was well aware of the risks, but you know, I didn't perceive the risk to myself to be so great that I wasn't going to do the work.
So did you work with ventilation hoods?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the lab, you know, all our work was done with, you know, the modern safety equipment. Yeah, ventilation hoods and gloves. And actually, we did a lot of stuff in glove boxes where you're totally isolated. You know, you're totally isolated from the chemicals. But I guess my point is just that I'm not someone who is totally chemophobic and afraid of all chemicals. I mean, as I said, I've worked up close and personal with them for a number of years before taking on this job.
Well, coming from a medical perspective, I'm pretty alert to the chemicals in common use. There are about 80,000 chemicals in common use, few of which have been tested for mutagenicity or carcinogenicity. And we use them with gay abandon. And let's get back to the pesticides. I mean, anything that kills living cells in insects and worms and the like is going to damage living cells in human bodies, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. You know, it's important not to lose track of the fact that pesticides are engineered and released into the environment specifically to kill living organisms, and therefore it's totally reasonable to expect that they might have adverse effects on human beings as well.
Well, when I first wrote my book, If You Love This Planet, in 1991, I remember reading that there are 45 or 46 different pesticide chemicals on sultanas, currants. And also there are a lot on broccoli, for instance. And now that companies wax certain vegetables and fruit, people say you have to wash them to get the chemicals off, but you can't when they wax because they're under the wax. And also, obviously, some of the chemicals will be imbibed or absorbed by the fruit or vegetables, which is why the organic food movement grew up. But let's talk about persistent organic pollutants. Tell us what they are, please, Dr. Tupper.
Sure. Well, persistent organic pollutants are a class of chemicals in general. It's not just pesticides, but chemicals which stick around in the environment for a long time. And
How long?
Well, it depends. So things like DDT, DDT is sort of the iconic persistent organic pollutant. You know, it depends on exactly, you know, what you're talking about with your soil, what kind of soil or water or in animals, but it can be, you know, from months to years to decades, it's how long it can stick around. And other things, so there's a chemical called PFAS, perfluoro octane sulfonate, which is not a pesticide, it's an industrial chemical, but this chemical was just added to a big international treaty, which maybe we'll talk about. But anyways, PFAS basically doesn't degrade. All the PFAS that's ever been produced, and we're talking about, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of tons of this stuff.
Oh boy.
Still here.
What's it used for?
PFAS has seen a lot of uses. Everything, it's been used in textiles. It's been used in hydraulic fluid. It's got a number of industrial uses. So when they're making things like microchips or certain medical devices and certain photographic devices, it's used in those devices. So it's actually got a large number of uses.
Of applications. And now, so what about, you've noted persistent organic pollutants are used in agriculture and other areas like DDT, aldrin, endosulfan, lindane, etc. Would you like to describe each of those and their organic or biological effects?
Well, actually, let me just rewind a little bit too and talk about persistent organic pollutants in general. So,
yeah.
A lot of the early pesticides, of the early synthetic pesticides, were very persistent. Things like DDT, which, as I mentioned, can stick around in the environment for decades, or take decades to break down. Aldrin, endrin, chlordane, all these molecules, you know, the early pesticides. But at the time, it was thought that their persistence was a good thing because, you spray it in your field to control insects. Most of these things were insecticides. You'd spray them in the field and they would stick around, so they would have this residual activity. So, you'd spray once a season, and that's all you needed to do because the chemicals stuck around. The problem is, as we came to find out, is that, these things are really toxic. A number of them have been linked to cancer. Others, like DDT, were shown to have devastating ecological effects, thinning eggshells on birds of prey and causing collapse of a number of populations of, different types of birds, and a whole slew of other adverse effects on the environment.
Killing frogs? Does it kill frogs?
The concerns about amphibians that we currently hear about are centered more around other types of pesticides like organophosphates and things like atrazine.
Mm-hmm.
Although a lot of these earlier organochlorine pesticides like endosulfan, DDT, aldrin, endrin, they are also very toxic to amphibians and fish. But so we finally, figured out that persistence maybe isn't such a good property to have in a pesticide. Of course, that was after, hundreds of thousands of millions of pounds of these things had been released.
Oh, my God.
Or into the environment. And so, one of the Pesticide Action Network, the organization I work for, one of the reasons why we were founded almost 30 years ago now was because a lot of these pesticides had been banned here in the United States, a lot of these persistent pesticides like DDT and aldrin, endrin, but they're still being manufactured in the United States and sold to third world countries where they were still used with,
By which companies in the United States are manufacturing them now?
Well, currently, none of the pesticides that we've mentioned so far are being made in the United States. A number of these have, because of efforts by PANA, I sort of use PANA and PAN interchangeably.
Mm.
But anyways, because of efforts by us and other environmental organizations, a number of these things have been banned for use globally under the Stockholm Convention on persistent organic pollutants. And then the few that remain, the few persistent organic pollutant pesticides that are still used in the United States and abroad, most of these are no longer made in the United States. Endosulfan is probably the most well-known and the most used pesticide that's a POP that's still being used today. And it's used in the United States, Australia, where you are, and a number of other countries, but it is actually being primarily produced in India and Israel.
Israel.
Yeah, there's a the company in Israel called Mac, I'm going to butcher the name of the company, but it's called Macdishin Agin, and they produce generic pesticides. So all these pesticides that have been come off patent, things like endosulfan and other pesticides and chemicals that, you know, other bigger companies don't want to deal with anymore because they're too toxic and there's too many hassles, legal hassles. Macdishin Agin and a few other companies around the world get the rights to these chemicals and continue to produce them. And so there are them and some companies in India and China are the primary producers of endosulfan these days.
Is endosulfan, it's just a pesticide, is it?
Yeah, endosulfan has only been used as an insecticide and a miticide, you know, to kill mites. It hasn't seen any industrial uses.
And these persistent organic pollutants, DDT, aldrin, endosulfan, lindane, etc., are they absorbed actually when they're sprayed into the vegetables and fruit?
That's a good question. These particular pesticides, I think for the most part, are not what we call systematic insecticides. They're not things that are taken up by the plant and become a part of the plant. So endosulfan, you know, you should be able to, in theory, you should be able to wash it off of an apple or a tomato.
Unless it's waxed. What about when they get on the soil? Are they absorbed through the root system of the plants?
Yeah, I don't, again, this is not an area of my expertise, but I don't believe that pesticides that we're talking about right now are. There is a big problem with, you know, they are persistent. So DDT that was sprayed 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you can still find it in the soil here in California and other places around the world. And it gets into the food chain because these things tend to be bioaccumulative.
Yeah.
So, you know, as was shown with, you know, Rachel Carson back in the 60s was talking about biomagnification through the food chain where, you know, you spray a bunch of DDT to kill bugs, those bugs die, a rat eats those bugs, and now the rat has a higher concentration of DDT in its system than those bugs did. A cat comes along and eats those rats, and now the cat has sort of accumulating all this DDT in its system, and then maybe that cat finally picked off by an eagle. And so these apex predators at the top of the food chain have the highest level of DDT in their system. And, you know, this is what Rachel Carson was talking about back in the 60s, but we still see this today, particularly with things like DDT, because it is so persistent. You know, cows grazing on it absorb this, cows grazing on, you know, grass that's been grown in fields that contaminated with DDT, they end up with DDT in their system, which comes out in the
and
milk.
The meat.
And in the meat. And actually data collected by, you can look up, we have a website called whatsonmyfood.org where we basically put USDA data online for different foods and the pesticide content of different foods. And so what you see is that, you know, most milk products and many, you know, a large percentage of meat products are contaminated with DDT or its metabolite DDE. And then, you know, we eat those products and it ends up in our system. And we're sort of at we're apex, you know, we're at the top of the food chain as well, just like eagles are. So, you know, human beings are definitely, you know, highly exposed to these pesticides, even though we banned them here in the United States. You know, we haven't used DDT in agriculture since 1972, but it's still, you know,
hanging around.
About every American, you know, if you test any American, you're going to find DDT in their body.
It's the biomagnification in the food chain is very similar with radioactive isotopes that emanate from nuclear power plants continuously as they operate, and from, you know, the nuclear waste that's leaking and leaching into water throughout the United States and bioconcentrating in food chains. So it's a very similar mechanism. Now let's get on. You're very interested in another pesticide, atrazine. And you say that, tell us what atrazine is, number one. And number two, it's already been banned by the European Union. And number three, It's in much drinking water in the United States. And number four, it's made by Syngenta, a company that says it's nothing to worry about. So let's get stuck into atrazine and Syngenta.
Sure. Yes, so atrazine, it's been in the news a lot lately, at least here in the United States. And it is an herbicide that is used primarily on corn. Most atrazine is used on corn, and most corn in the United States grown in the Midwest, so Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Nebraska, that part of the country. Mm. And it's the second most used pesticide in the United States. I'm considering herbicide to be a pesticide.
Oh, okay.
But so, you know, of all the herbicides, fungicides, insecticides, you know, used in the U.S., atrazine is the, you know, there's the second most commonly used chemical.
Really?
And we're talking, we're talking like 80 million pounds a year.
Oh my God.
It's a lot of chemical to be spraying on cornfields. You know, the people who make it and support it say that it, you know, it increases yields of corn, and that, you know, it makes corn more profitable for farmers to
grow. How does it increase the yield?
Well, it's, you know, it's an herbicide, so it's killing. The idea is that it kills other, you know, invasive plants that would be competing with the corn for nutrients.
Mm.
And it also, I think this, my understanding is that the exact sort of chemical mechanism by which this happens hasn't been worked out yet. But it also just appears to, like, kind of like a fertilizer, just gives the corn a boost in yield.
Mm.
I was going to say, other studies have said that the sort of economic gains realized by farmers from the use of atrazine are actually quite small, like, you know, 1%. So, you know, the big argument for the continued use of atrazine is that, well, you know, farmers need this to be competitive and you know, economically they're dependent upon it. And, you know, there's really not a lot of data to support that claim because, you know, EU's already banned it. Their farmers are doing fine. And as I said, a lot of studies suggest that, you know, the economic benefits to farmers are actually quite minimal.
So why is it scary? What's scary about atrazine?
Yeah. So what's the reason why it's received so much attention lately, and so many groups, including Pesticide Action Network, have been campaigning to, you know, for a ban on atrazine, is because of two things, really. One, it's a ubiquitous water contaminant. Wherever it's used, you see it in the water. You see it in the surface water, in the lakes, where, you know, fish and frogs and, you know, other wildlife are exposed to it. And you also see it in drinking water. So, you know, chances are if you live in the Midwest, if you live around where this chemical is being used, you know, open up your, turn on your faucet and get a drink of water, chances are there's atrazine in that water.
Mm.
You know, very small amounts, but chances are it's there.
Mm.
Like, you know, various government agencies, the EPA, the USDA, United States Geological Survey, they've all done their own drinking water sampling. And for example, the USDA finds atrazine in something like 80% of water samples in the United States.
Oh, my God.
So that's the first thing, is it's in the water.
Okay.
And that maybe wouldn't be such a problem, except for the fact that there's a lot of evidence that suggests that, you know, atrazine is really bad, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that atrazine can adversely affect people, particularly, you know, the developing fetus, and also that it can affect, you know, wildlife. And it can do so at levels that that you see in the real world, you know, that you see in people's water, you know, groundwater.
So how does atrazine affect fetuses and animals?
Well, in experimental animals, so in, you know, toxicological studies done by done mostly by the chemical companies that make atrazine, you see things like cancer and certain types of birth defects. It's, you know, it's, what we call an endocrine disruptor, meaning that it interferes with the body's own hormone system. So that, you know, the body is sending all these little chemical signals, especially during development, you know, to say, you know, grow a foot here and, you know, grow a brain there and all these, and then, you know, during adolescence, it's directing sexual maturity, you know, growth towards puberty and stuff like that.
Mm.
So there's a lot of evidence from experimental animals, you know, rats and mice, that it affects the endocrine system.
And the and the genitalia.
Right. So that's what, you know, that's what we see in rats and mice. And then there's even some epidemiology. So now looking at humans and trying to correlate human exposure to atrazine to adverse health effects. There's several studies pointing to things like exposure during pregnancy causing low birth weight babies. And that's a big problem because low birth weight itself is associated with a lot of problems down the road. So if, you know, if you're born underweight, then, you know, you're at much higher risk for things like developmental disorders and just general sickness later on in life. And it seems as though atrazine is a risk factor for low birth weight.
What about abnormalities with the genitalia?
Right. So there's a number of birth defects that have been seen. And there's also spontaneous or higher incidence of spontaneous abortion or miscarriage amongst women who are highly exposed to atrazine. And then particularly amongst, so moving from people to wildlife now, there's been a lot of research into effects on particularly male genitalia in frogs in particular. And what's been found is that at really, really, really low levels of exposure, like, you know, a tenth of a part per billion, which is much lower than the levels of atrazine that you routinely see in lakes and streams and
yeah.
in some cases drinking water, what you see is that male frogs, or male tadpoles, I should say, are growing things like ovaries where there should be testes and effects like this. So the main researcher who's been doing this work is a professor at UC Berkeley here in California named Tyrone Hayes. And, you know, he describes it as a chemical castration or a demasculinization of these tadpoles. And, of course, you know, you have to say to yourself, if it can do this to tadpoles at 0.1 part per billion, you know, what could it be doing to human beings? And so that's, you know, a major cause for concern that, you know, that sort of underlines why we're so concerned about these levels of atrazine that we're seeing in the water supply.
So didn't Syngenta pay Tyrone Hayes to do the study on frogs, and then when he found out it turns them into hermaphrodites and the like, Syngenta tried to suppress the findings of Tyrone Hayes?
Yeah, so that's absolutely right. So Syngenta is a big agrochemical company that's based out of Switzerland, and they are not the only company that manufactures atrazine, but they're the biggest one and sort of atrazine's biggest defender, and I think they were the ones who originally developed atrazine, although now it's off patent, so other companies can make it. But anyways, Syngenta's, you know, the major agrochemical company that's responsible for atrazine. And
I was just going to say, these chemical companies scare the bejesus out of me as a physician and a pediatrician.
Yeah.
You know, 80 million tons of atrazine produced per year. I mean, in America, that's absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, it's 80 million pounds, not
pounds.
Tons.
Oh, sorry,
in
pounds.
In America.
Okay.
Yeah, no, but still, it's an incredible number.
Yeah.
And but to get back to Professor Hayes' story, so they paid, I think it was, I don't have the dates in my head, either in the late 90s or early 2000s, Syngenta commissioned Hayes to do a study to look at the effects of atrazine on tadpoles. And you know, at that point, Hayes was happy to do the work. He didn't see it as a conflict of interest or that, you know, he would be in any way compromised by, you know, working for the integrity of his work would be compromised by working for Syngenta. And so he went about and did these studies. And to everyone's surprise, most especially Syngenta, he found that very low levels of atrazine were affecting male frogs and, you know, changing them into demasculinizing them, as he says. And Syngenta didn't like this at all and tried to keep him from publishing his results and bury the results. And this is, you know, this is when Dr. Hayes got just really TO'd. And, you know, he sort of has since become, you know, one of the loudest voices out there to, you know, raising the alarm about atrazine. And he's gone on to publish a number of studies documenting how atrazine affects, you know, gonad development in amphibians. And, you know, now he's sort of one of the foremost experts on the subject. And, you know, Syngenta continues to argue that, you know, Hayes' findings, you know, not to worry about them, or they, you know, they commissioned their own studies that were done much, you know, very poorly. And, of course, they didn't, you know, they were unable to reproduce his findings, but, you know, mostly because their studies were so, you know, so poorly conducted. So that's the story with, you know, atrazine and frog.
That's pretty bad news. My special guest today is Carl Tupper, the staff scientist with the Pesticide Action Network of North America and coordinator of their environmental monitoring program. So, Carl Tupper, let's move on then to the Stockholm Convention and endosulfan.
Sure. So switching gears. Stockholm Convention is an international treaty signed by something like 160-plus countries around the world to outlaw persistent organic pollutants, the chemicals that we were talking about earlier that persist in the environment, bioaccumulate in food chains, and, you know, pose a significant threat to humans and to wildlife. And this is a treaty that was negotiated you know, in the last 10 years, and it bans things like the agricultural use of DDT, although DDT is still allowed to be used for malaria control under the treaty. It bans things like PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, which have, you know, they were used in transformers and a lot of other industrial applications that have been found to be really persistent and linked to a number of health, you know, health problems. It also bans things like dioxins, a number of the old pesticides that we talked about earlier, like Chlordane, Aldrin, Endrin, Myrex, things like that. And it's interesting to point out that the United States signed the Stockholm Convention, but we have not yet ratified it, so we are not bound by it. Because we haven't ratified it, we are... the extent to which the United States can participate in the ongoing negotiations of the Stockholm Convention is really, you know, attenuated. Like, you know, the U.S. sort of only participates as an observer, basically.
An observer,
But anyways, that's a different story. The thing with the Stockholm Convention is that it's a living treaty. Chemicals, there's a provision in it. When it first passed in 2004, first entered into effect in 2004, there was this initial list of 12 chemicals, the Dirty Dozen, which contained those chemicals I just mentioned. But there's a provision in the treaty for amending it, for adding more chemicals to the treaty. And actually at the last meeting of the treaty, which was in May, 9 additional chemicals were added to the treaty, which was great. And these are things like a number of pesticides, lindane and chlordecone, and then some...
hexachlorobenzene?
Yeah, hexachlorobenzene, a number of flame retardants, and PFOS, which we mentioned earlier as being very, very persistent. These were all added to the treaty, and not without controversy, and we could go into the minutiae of all that. But now there's another crop of pests, of chemicals that are moving through the process, and hopefully will be added to the treaty within the next few years. One of which is an insecticide called endosulfan. And endosulfan is one of the last of the old school, highly persistent pesticides that's still around, that's still actively being used. And this is a chemical that has been, you know, it's still used in the United States, still used in Australia, but more than 60 countries, including the European Union, have banned it already. And it's not just sort of wealthy, industrialized countries like the countries of the European Union. It's also places like the Philippines and Sri Lanka and Thailand.
So America's a little backward in coming forward to do the right thing, correct?
Yeah, definitely.
With the Stockholm Convention.
Yeah, I think, you know, the U.S., we haven't ratified the Stockholm Convention. That's tragic. And with regards to endosulfan, you know, we still allow the use of endosulfan here in the United States, although the EPA is currently reviewing endosulfan. They have been for the last few years. But, you know, we're very hopeful that they're going to pull the plug on it and say enough is enough.
Especially under Obama. Now, I've got another question, Carl Tupper. Monsanto now incorporates insecticides into the genome of corn and the like, so that when the insect eats the corn or whatever, it dies, and that means that the insecticide is actually intrinsic in the food itself. Tell us what you think about that to human health.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a good thing. There's two sort of genetically modified, the two strategies that companies like Monsanto have used to genetically modify crops for pesticide purposes. One is to make them resistant to herbicides. And, you know, Monsanto has pioneered this with their Roundup Ready corn and other crops. So in this case, there's not actually a pesticide in the crop itself, but they've made it, you know, these are crops that otherwise would be killed by herbicides, but they've made them resistant to the herbicides. So now farmers can go ahead and spray all the glyphosate that they want. And, you know, knowing that, you know, their crop will survive, but all the weeds will die.
Yeah.
That's the idea. And the other way is to actually engineer the crop so that it produces its own pesticide.
Mm.
And that is sort of, again, kind of straying from my area of expertise. But I think BT is the primary pesticide that's been incorporated into crops this way. And BT is actually, stands for Bacillus thuringiensis. And it's a bacterium that produces a toxin that is toxic to insects. And BT itself is actually very non-toxic, and it's one of the pesticides that can be used on organic crops. But so what these companies have done, though, is they've taken the genes out of the BT microorganism and the genes that make this toxin and inserted them into the genome of, you know, different food crops. And so now those food crops make this pesticide, and you know, insects that would be eat the crop, you know, they get a dose of the BT toxin, and that kills them. And while BT is definitely one of the less toxic of all the pesticides that are out there, it is still, you know, we're still gravely concerned about this trend of incorporating pesticides into
food.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I was just going to say, I mean, you know, regardless of whether the crops are being modified to produce a pesticide or to be, you know, just to have certain traits that, you know, someone decides are desirable, you know, Hannah's position has been that, you know, genetic modification of organisms is wrong and not something that we should be pursuing.
Totally agree.
I mean, we recognize that, you know, there's world's got something like 7 billion people in it, and we need to feed all them. But, you know, but modifying organisms at the genetic level is not the way to do it.
Now, let's move on, because you've got a fascinating paragraph here about conservative, libertarian, far-right-wing politicians like Senator Tom Coburn, Fox News commentators Glenn Beck, who I've only just realised is around. I don't know how long he's been around, and Stephen Malloy, and then right-wing think tanks clearly funded by the corporations that make these toxins, Competitive Enterprise Institute, American Enterprise Institute, etc. And they're attacking, of course, they attack Rachel Carson, who wrote that magnificent book, Silent Spring, and who tragically died of breast cancer shortly thereafter, but she really led a revolution with the book. What are these right-wingers? They're trying to discredit the environmental movement by attacking Rachel Carson, rewriting history and the science of malaria control. Would you like to talk about these particular people, Carl
sure.
Tupper? Yeah, I'd really like to hear.
I mean, I think, you know, Rachel Carson is really sort of a grandmother of the environmental movement. And, you know, you and I are sitting here, you and I probably wouldn't be sitting here today doing what we do, certainly not having this conversation if it wasn't for Rachel
yes.
Carson. She really catalyzed the environmental movement, you know, not just in the United States, but in, you know, in the whole world. And she was focused on DET, but that's carried over into all other, you know, it's not just pesticides, that's carried over into all other realms of environmentalism. And, you know, her book, Silent Spring, you know, also very instrumental in getting Congress to implement legislation that eventually led to the establishment of the Environmental Protection Agency. And she's, you know, very iconic figure, and DDT is a very iconic chemical as a result of her, of what she's done. And, you know, to people like you and me and listeners to this show, that's all a good thing. But if you're a chemical company, or, you know, any kind of company that might be subject to regulation of the environment, then maybe Rachel Carson's legacy isn't such a good thing, or at least not to your bottom line. You know, if you produce large amounts of toxic waste that you need to pay lots of money to get rid of because the government won't let you just dump it into a river, then, you know, Rachel Carson's legacy is a real thorn in your side. And so in the last few years, over the last 10 years, but really culminating with what would have been Rachel Carson's 100th birthday last year, there's been a concerted effort on the coming mostly out of the right wing to discredit Rachel Carson. And, you know, if you Google around, if you put DDT malaria into Google and see what comes up, you'll find a lot of people, a lot of authors writing, saying things like, you know, Rachel Carson was wrong, DDT is fine, it's not toxic, it never caused the ecological catastrophes that we think it caused, things like eggshell thinning and, you know, nearly causing the extinction of bald eagles and stuff like that. And they say that it's not that toxic. And then they say that it's been banned for malaria control, and as a result, you know, there's millions of people dying of malaria every year. And none of that's true.
And it's Rachel Carson's fault.
Yeah, and it's Rachel Carson's fault. And it's very, you know, at first we were perplexed, like, well, why is there so much effort being put into all these lies about Rachel
yeah.
Carson and DDT?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think when you look at who's spreading these myths, it's the same folks who are denying that global warming is the problem.
Yep.
And it's the same folks that, you know, are poo-pooing organic food. And it's the same folks who, many of the same, of the exact same people who were involved in disputing whether or not secondhand smoke causes cancer are the same people who are spreading this myth. And so,
and that nuclear power is safe?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think it's best understood in context of trying to discredit and smear Rachel Carson, and by in doing so sort of cast doubt on the whole environmental movement, and ultimately to you know, if they can convince the American public that, you know, to be skeptical of the environmental movement, then that makes it a lot easier for them to push their deregulatory agenda. So, you know, we shouldn't be regulating these chemicals in the food supply, and we shouldn't be, you know, regulating what can come out of smokestacks. You know, this is just, you know, this is all just, you know, unnecessary, unwarranted controls that, you know, ultimately harm business.
Interference with the free market system. And I only found out the other day that the term free market means free from any government regulation. I didn't know that. It's very interesting. But, you know, what worries me, Carl Tupper, is that the medical profession are slow to move on this. We tend to wait in our consulting rooms and hospitals till the patients present with, you know, hermaphrodite babies and carcinomas, you name it. And instead of taking a really good history about where the patient lives, as in California near the fields, or in Iowa where the water contains atrazine, or where they've worked, we tend to deal with the problem at hand, the specific diagnosis, and then give them chemotherapy or whatever. And it seems imperative to me, because preventive medicine is the cheapest way to approach healthcare, that the medical profession, the AMA and all the other colleges, should rise up and the American Public Health Association and get deeply, deeply involved in these issues, because we see the end results of these chemical companies, and their propaganda must be negated by the people who need to do that, and that's the medical profession.
Yeah, I agree. It would be great if those organizations you mentioned, the AMA and other folks, you know, would be take a more proactive view of all this. But it's not surprising. I mean, you know, no, there's a lot of the chemical industry has a lot of money.
Yep.
And it's not something that for the lighthearted stand up to.
Yeah, you must see this all the time. Do they attack you, Carl Tupper?
I've been attacked in a few like op-eds and places like that, but you know that's been about the brunt of it. Pesticide Action Network, as an organization, you know, fairly regularly gets you know, slammed in the media, you know, by ag interests. They say, oh, these activists from Pesticide Action Network spreading fear.
Oh, yeah, you mustn't spread fear.
yeah. But, you know, like when Paul Driesen, who's the author of this ridiculous book called, like, Green Fear, Black Death, or some this book that just basically says that, like, environmentalists are killing everyone with our policies, you know, he actually wrote a letter to the editor of a newspaper in response, something that I had written and you know, called me names. And I consider that to be more of a badge of honor, you know, and you can get like the one of the leading anti-environmentalists to denounce you personally. No, you're
yeah,
doing
it's like being
right.
Being on Nixon's blacklist. Or as Maggie Thatcher said, when people, and I didn't ever like Maggie Thatcher at all, but if people really attack me on certain policies personally, I know that I'm having a profound impact with my policy, so I get the same thing, of course.
Yeah.
You have to have a thick skin, right?
Yeah, well, it's not, yeah, you do, but it's not.
And also be absolutely scientifically rigorous, and so that there's no room for attack. Well, look, I think we've run out of time, Carl Tupper. It's been a wonderful interview, very rewarding, very educational. And I know that there'll be many questions that people will want to ask. And if they go to your webpage at www.panna.org, they can look up much more of this information and learn about how they're impacted by chemicals in their everyday life.
Indeed. And I'll also just point out that there are a number of opportunities on our website to take action on different issues, things like send a petition here or, you know, ways you can modify your lifestyle. So, you know, if you're interested in these issues, please do stop by www.panna.org and check it out.
All right. Well, thank you very much again for this interview, and I wish you luck in your work, Carl Tupper.
Thanks a lot, Helen.
My guest today was Carl Tupper, staff scientist with the Pesticide Action Network North America and coordinator of their environmental monitoring program. And again, his webpage is www.panna.org. And don't forget, if you would like to contribute to our fabulous radio show, If You Love This Planet, and I'm sure you would, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org, where in fact there are about 60 shows available now for you to download, but also there is a contribution page, and we'd be incredibly grateful if you did help us, because we have to pay our producer, pay for equipment and the like, and we really want to keep this show going. I think it's very important. I'm about to read from my new book, If You Love This Planet, published in 2009 by W.W. Norton. We must be very conscious of the chemical composition of the food we eat. Our grandparents ate fruit that was not perfectly formed and perhaps contained a few worms, but it tasted delicious. The farmers began using sprays to kill pests and increase their crop yields. Before long, chemical companies got into the act and agricultural products became a large portion of their business. Initially, the yields of chemically treated crops increased quite dramatically, but over time the predatory insects and parasites mutated and developed immunity to the sprays. So the chemical companies developed new and more exotic poisons to combat this human-induced immunity. Despite these carefully applied chemicals, however, crop losses caused by pests have actually increased since the 1940s, from 32% to 37% by 1991. Meanwhile, the soil has been contaminated. As a result, worms and naturally occurring microorganisms that form the base of the pyramid of the food chain have been killed, and bees and birds that fertilize the crops have been poisoned. In a random sampling of fruits and vegetables in 1995, the US FDA discovered that 60% of the fruits and 37% of the vegetables had pesticide residue on them. About 2% of these fruits and vegetables contained pesticide amounts that exceeded maximum limits established by the EPA. It's a terrible thing to realize that the food we put into our mouths could be poisoning us. Amazingly, less than 0.1% of all pesticides ever reach the target insects. The other 99.9% is dispersed in groundwater, lakes, weirs, soil, and the air. Groundwater has been contaminated with more than 50 varieties of pesticides in some 30 US states. In a study on pesticides and water conducted in 1998, the US Geological Survey found that 95% of streams and 50% of wells close to agricultural and urban areas were contaminated with pesticides. The use of pesticides increased from £300 million annually in 1966 to more than £1 billion in 1988. The US now uses £1.2 billion of pesticides a year, and £5 billion a year are used globally. The World Health Organization estimated in 1995 that roughly 3 million cases of pesticide poisoning occur each year, two-thirds of them happening in developing countries, including 220,000 pesticide-related deaths, mostly of people who use or apply pesticides. Pesticides are also used by people as the leading method of suicide, according to WHO. The National Academy of Sciences reports that pesticides in food may cause 1 million cases of cancer in this generation of Americans. It was predicted in 1998 that on a yearly basis, 1 million Americans would learn they have cancer, 500,000 would die of cancer, and 10,400 Americans would die of cancer related to pesticides. All this ecological damage to grow unblemished, artificially beautiful food. I believe it's better to eat a sweet, chemically uncontaminated apple containing a worm than a visually perfect toxic apple that tastes like cardboard. Farming can be made safe. Organic farming relies on mulch, compost, manure, and naturally occurring pesticides, has been proven to be more productive than chemical farming. But that's true only if the water and soil used to raise the crops are absolutely not contaminated with chemicals. Before we can clean up our lives and cure the planet, we must recognize the extraordinary damage that our lifestyle inflicts on the planet. When I was a child, women wore silk stockings and silk rayon or cotton underwear. Floors were covered with linoleum or woolen carpets. China plates, metal cutlery and glass were used in the kitchen, and garbage consisted of food scraps wrapped in old newspapers. The trash can was a small lidded metal can that was put out weekly for collection, and once a week the iceman placed a block of ice in the top of our ice chest, which kept the food cold. The milk was delivered at 5 o'clock each morning by a milkman driving a horse and cart. Fresh bread was delivered at lunchtime, and Dad grew most of our fruits and vegetables. On the weekends, my father walked the streets with a bucket and spade, collecting horse manure to fertilize the garden. Our life was healthy and relatively free of artificial chemicals. When I was 8, someone showed me a nylon doorknob. It looked like a magic material, and intuitively I knew it heralded the dawn of a new era, the plastic age. With some trepidation, I watched the introduction of Laminex laboratory benchtops, vinyl floor tiles, plastic lavatory seats, plastic covered furniture, plastic piping for plumbing, plastic filled planes and cars, plastic disposable kitchen utensils, and plastic medical equipment. The gravity of the situation became apparent when I was a medical resident in 1972. I asked a hospital administrator why we used disposable plastic scissors, scalpels, forceps, and so on, instead of metal surgical instruments. He told me it was cheaper to buy plastic and throw it away than to employ people to wash steel implements. 40 years later, the situation is totally out of hand. I've witnessed the takeover of the world by plastic. In the hotel rooms I stay in on my travels, there's a plastic sachet full of non-biodegradable shampoo, a plastic shower cap, and 2 plastic cups all wrapped in plastic. Americans and many other people have become obsessed with bottled water. An average of 40 billion plastic water bottles are used each year in the United States. Or, to put it in another context, Americans drink about 8 million gallons of bottled water a year, and they spend $11 billion on water, making bottled water the fastest growing segment of the beverage industry. This is Helen Caldicott, and I've been reading an extract from my new book, If You Love This Planet, published in 2009 by W.W. Norton. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.